But Lorenzo de' Medici gave him few, if any, commissions, and sent him away carrying a lyre as a diplomatic gift. As for Ludovico Sforza, it was many years after Leonardo's arrival in Milan before he was invited to become part of the ducal court, and his most important commission, the horse monument, was scuttled by the Duke. After France captured Milan in 1499, Leonardo tried to curry favour with a variety of powerful men, including the French governor of Milan, Charles d'Amboise, the brutal Italian warrior Cesare Borgia, and the hapless papal brother Giuliano de' Medici. But in each case, the fit was not perfect. Then, on his trip to Bologna with Pope Leo X in December 1515, Leonardo met the new King of France, Francis I, who had just turned 21. See figure 137 in the PDF. At the beginning of that year, he had succeeded his father-in-law, Louis XII, who admired Leonardo, collected his works, and was among the few who could entice him to paint. Right before he met Leonardo in Bologna, Francis had wrested control of Milan from the Sforzas, just as Louis had done in 1499. When they were in Bologna together, Francis probably invited Leonardo to come to France. Leonardo instead returned to Rome, but only briefly, perhaps to get his affairs in order. During that period, Francis and his court kept up efforts to recruit him, encouraged in that task by Francis's mother, Louise de Savoie. "I beg you to urge Master Leonardo that he should come to the king's presence," a member of Francis's court wrote to their ambassador in Rome in March 1516, adding that Leonardo should be wholeheartedly assured that he will be most welcome, both by the king and by Madame, his mother. That month, Giuliano de' Medici died. Beginning during his early career in Florence, Leonardo's relationship to the Medici family had been uncomfortable. "The Medici made me and destroyed me," he wrote, cryptically, in his notebook at the time of Giuliano's death. He then accepted the French invitation, and in the summer of 1516, before the snows made the Alps impassable, he left Rome to join the court of the king, who would be his final and most devoted patron. Leonardo had never been out of Italy before. He was 64 but looked older, and knew this was likely to be his last journey. His entourage was accompanied by several mules that carried his household furniture, trunks of clothing and manuscripts, and at least three paintings he was still obsessively perfecting: the Virgin and Child with St. Anne, St. John the Baptist, and the Mona Lisa. Along the way, he and his travelling party stopped in Milan. Salai decided to stay there, at least temporarily. He was then 36, solidly middle-aged, and no longer playing the role of Leonardo's pretty boy companion or competing for attention with the aristocratic Melzi, who was still only 25 and remained at Leonardo's side. Salai would settle down at the vineyard and house on the edge of Milan that had been given to Leonardo by Ludovico Sforza. Over the next 3 years, until Leonardo's death, he would visit Leonardo in France but spend little time there. He received only one stipend payment, which was 1/8 the total of the regular ones that Melzi received. Perhaps another reason Salai stayed behind was that Leonardo had a new manservant, Battista de Villanis, who travelled with him from Rome to France. He would soon replace Salai in Leonardo's affections. Salai would end up inheriting only half of the Milan vineyard and its rights. Battista would get the other half. Francis I. King Francis I was 6 feet tall, had broad shoulders, and displayed the charisma and courage that appealed to Leonardo. He loved leading his troops into battle. With his standard flying high, he would ride directly to the front lines. He was also, unlike Borgia and some of Leonardo's previous patrons, a civilized and decent man. When Francis captured Milan, instead of killing or even imprisoning its duke, Maximilian Sforza, he let him live at the French court. Through his cultured mother, Louise de Savoie, and his bevy of dedicated and accomplished tutors, Francis was inculcated with a love of the Italian Renaissance. Unlike the Italian dukes and princes, French kings had collected very few paintings and almost no sculpture, and French art was greatly overshadowed by that of the Italians and Flemish. Francis set out to change that. He had the ambition, which he largely fulfilled, of launching in France the Renaissance that had been sweeping Italy. He was also a voracious seeker of knowledge, with interests as universal as Leonardo's. He loved science and math, geography and history, poetry and music and literature. He learned Italian, Latin, Spanish and Hebrew. Personally gregarious and with women lascivious, he cut a dashing figure as a graceful dancer, expert hunter and powerful wrestler. After spending a few hours each morning on affairs of state, he would have someone read to him the great writers of ancient Rome and Greece. He also put on plays and pageants in the evening. Leonardo was the perfect recruit for his court. Likewise, Francis proved to be the perfect patron for Leonardo. He would admire Leonardo unconditionally, never pester him about finishing paintings, indulge his love of engineering and architecture, encourage him to stage pageants and fantasias, give him a comfortable home, and pay him a regular stipend. Leonardo was given the title First Painter, Engineer, and Architect to the King. But his value to Francis was his intellect and not his output. Francis had an unquenchable thirst for learning, and Leonardo was the world's best source of experiential knowledge. He could teach the king about almost any subject there was to know, from how the eye works to why the moon shines. In turn, Leonardo could learn from the erudite and graceful young king. As Leonardo once wrote in his notebooks, referring to Alexander the Great and his tutor, Alexander and Aristotle were teachers of one another. Francis became completely enamored with Leonardo, according to the sculptor Cellini. He took such pleasure in hearing him discourse that there were few days in the year when he was parted from him, which was one of the reasons why Leonardo did not manage to pursue to the end his miraculous studies. Cellini later quoted Francis declaring that he could never believe there was another man born in this world who knew as much as Leonardo, and not only of sculpture, painting and architecture, and that he was truly a great philosopher. Francis gave Leonardo something he had continually sought, a comfortable stipend that was not dependent on producing any paintings. In addition, he was given the use of a small red brick manor house with sandstone trimming and playful spires next to Francis's castle in the Loire Valley village of Amboise. Known as the Château des Clous and now called Clos Lucé, Leonardo's house, see figure 138, was set amid almost 3 acres of gardens and vineyards and connected by an underground tunnel to the king's Château d'Amboise, about 500 yards away. The large hall on the ground floor was spacious without being cold and formal. There Leonardo ate with his retinue and visitors. Above it was Leonardo's large bedroom, which had thick oak beams, a stone fireplace, and a view over a grassy slope to the king's chateau. See figure 139. Melzi probably had the other room on the second floor. He drew a sketch of the view from one of its windows. He kept a list of books that Leonardo, ever curious, wanted him to procure. Among them, a study of the formation of the fetus in the womb, which had just been published in Paris, and a printed volume by Roger Bacon, the 13th century friar from Oxford, who was a forerunner of Leonardo as a scientific experimenter. As he had for his previous patrons, Leonardo designed and staged pageants for King Francis. In May 1518, for example, there were celebrations at Amboise to mark the baptism of the king's son and the marriage of his niece. The preparations included the construction of an arch topped by a salamander and an ermine, symbolizing the rapprochement between France and Italy. The piazza was transformed into a theatrical fortress with fake artillery, firing air-inflated balls with great blasting and smoking effects, according to a dispatch from one diplomat. These balls, falling on the piazza, bounced all over to everyone's delight and without any damage. A Leonardo drawing from 1518, showing a mechanical device to hurl balls, is usually regarded as an example of his military engineering, but it was, I think, for this pageant. At an open-air banquet and dance for the king in the gardens of the Château des Clous the following month, Leonardo helped to recreate scenes from the performance he had staged almost 30 years earlier in Milan for the wedding of Giangaleazzo Sforza to Isabella of Aragon. The play Paradiso, by the poet Bernardo Bellincioni, with players costumed as each of the seven known planets and the mechanical marvel of an egg-shaped orb opening up to reveal paradise. The courtyard was entirely covered with sky-blue sheets with golden-hued stars to look like the sky, one ambassador reported. There must have been 400 two-branched candelabras, which gave so much light that it was as if the night had been chased away. The plays and masquerades were fleeting, but some of Leonardo's drawings for them remain. One beautiful sheet shows a young man on horseback, holding a lance and wearing an elaborate costume with helmet, feathers, and multiple layers of garment. Figure 140. The De Beatis Visit. In October 1517, after Leonardo had been in Amboise for a year, he received a distinguished visitor, Cardinal Luigi of Aragon, who was taking a prolonged trip through Europe accompanied by more than 40 members of his entourage. They had known each other in Rome, where the cardinal entertained grandly and was renowned for his gorgeous mistress, with whom he had a daughter. Accompanying him was his chaplain and secretary, Antonio de Beatis, whose diary provides us with our final close-up scene of Leonardo as a lion in winter. De Beatis referred to Leonardo as the most eminent painter of our time, which was certainly true, but provides evidence that he was regarded as such by his contemporaries, even though the Mona Lisa, the St. Anne, and the St. John had not been widely seen, and many of his public commissions, from the Adoration of the Magi to the Battle of Anghiari, had been left unfinished. De Beatis described Leonardo, then 65, as a grey beard of more than 70 years. This is interesting because many of the possible portraits of Leonardo, including the one in red chalk in Turin, widely considered a self-portrait, are sometimes dismissed because they show a subject who seems to be older than Leonardo was. Perhaps, however, Leonardo did in fact look older than he was. By the time he reached his 60s, his despairs and demons may have wizened him. We can imagine the scene. The visitors are welcomed into the large oak-beamed hall of the manor house, are served drinks by Leonardo's cook, Maturin, and Leonardo then proceeds to play the role of the venerable icon of art and science, hosting the guests in his upstairs studio chamber. He begins by showing the cardinal and his retinue three easel paintings that he had carried with him on his travels, one of a certain Florentine lady done from life at the instigation of the late Giuliano de' Medici. The second is of the youthful St. John the Baptist, and a third of the Madonna with the Child placed on the lap of St. Anne, all of the highest perfection. Other than launching a subcult of scholars who have come up with alternative theories about the Mona Lisa based on De Beatis' account, the scene is sweetly reassuring. Here is Leonardo, in a comfortable room with a large fireplace, nurturing the paintings he loves and showing them off as his private treasures. De Beatis also reported that Leonardo's ailments now included an apparent stroke. Because of a paralysis in his right hand, one can no longer expect any masterpieces from him. He has trained a Milanese disciple, Melzi, who works very well, for if Master Leonardo is no longer capable of painting with the gentleness of touch which was his, he nevertheless continues to draw and teach. There is a typical Leonardo mystery here. He is left-handed, so perhaps the paralysis did not affect him much. We know that he was still drawing in Amboise, and while there, he reworked the face and the blue drapery clothing on the left side of his St. Anne. Leonardo's carefully staged tour also included some glimpses of his notebooks and treatises. "This gentleman has written a great deal about anatomy," De Beatis reported, "with many illustrations of the parts of the body, such as the muscles, nerves, veins, and the coilings of intestines, and this makes it possible to understand the bodies of both men and women in a way that has never been done before. All this we saw with our own eyes, and he told us he had already dissected more than 30 bodies, both men and women, of all ages." Leonardo also described, but apparently did not put on display, the work he had done on science and engineering. He has also written, as he himself put it, an infinity of volumes on the nature of waters, on various machines, and on other things, all in the vernacular, and if these were to be brought to light, they would be both useful and delightful. De Beatis recorded that the books were in Italian, the vernacular, but he does not mention the very notable fact that they were written in mirror script. He probably was shown the anatomy drawings, but not the actual notebook pages. He is right about one thing. If they were to be published, they would be both useful and delightful. Alas, Leonardo was not spending his final years at Amboise preparing them for publication. Romorantin. Rather than commissioning a big piece of public art, the king offered Leonardo an ideal assignment for the culmination of his career, designing a new town and palace complex for the royal court at the village of Romorantin on the Sauldre River in the centre of France, some 50 miles from Amboise. It would, if it came to pass, allow the expression of many of Leonardo's passions: architecture, urban planning, waterworks, engineering, even pageantry and spectacle. In late 1517, he accompanied the king to Romorantin, where they stayed until January 1518. Drawing on the ideas and fantasies he had developed for an ideal city while living in Milan 30 years earlier, Leonardo began sketching in his notebook his radical and utopian aspirations for inventing a town from scratch. The plan was for an idyllic palace rather than a fortress-like castle. His interest in military engineering and fortifications had waned. Melzi took charge of pacing the measurements of the existing streets and recording them. Then Leonardo sketched several designs. One is centered on a three-story palace with arched walkways facing the river. Another imagines two castles, one of which would be for the king's mother, with part of the river between them. Featured in all the designs are a profusion of different types of staircases: double doglegs, triple spirals, and various other curves and twists. For Leonardo, staircases were locations for complex flows and twisting motions, which he always loved. All of the plans were conceived with great outdoor spectacles and water pageants in mind. The galleries, facing the river, could serve as tiered viewing areas, accommodating the entire French court, and there are broad steps that gently lead down to the water level. His drawings show small boats parading on the river and on man-made lakes for aquatic spectacles. "The jousters are to be on the boats," he writes next to one. Leonardo's lifelong fascination with water suffuses all aspects of his plans for Romorantin, which feature a variety of aquatic engineering, both practical and decorative. As with the earth, the waterways serve both metaphorically and in reality as the veins of the palace complex. Leonardo envisioned their use for irrigation, street cleaning, flushing out horse stables, carrying away rubbish, and as wonderful displays and decorations. "There should be fountains in every plaza," he declared. "There should be four mills where the water enters the town and four at the outlet, and this may be done by damming the water above Romorantin." Leonardo had soon expanded his watery dreams to include the entire region. He envisioned a system of canals that would connect the Sauldre to the Loire and the Saône rivers, irrigate the region, and drain its marshes. Ever since he had marveled at the locks and canals that tamed the waters of Milan, he had tried to conquer the flow of water. He failed to do it with his plan for diverting the Arno near Florence or draining the Pontine marshes near Rome. Now he hoped to succeed at Romorantin. If the tributary of the Loire River were turned with its muddy waters into the river of Romorantin, it would fatten the land it waters, make the land fertile, supply food to the inhabitants, and serve as a navigable canal for commerce, he wrote. It was not to be. The project was abandoned in 1519, the year Leonardo died. Instead, the king decided to build his new chateau at Chambord, in the Loire Valley between Amboise and Romorantin. There the ground was less marshy, and fewer canals were required. The Deluge Drawings. Leonardo's interest in the art and science of movement, and in particular the flow and swirl of water and wind, climaxed in a series of turbulent drawings that he made during his final years in France. 16 of them, unknown to still exist, 11 of which were done together as a series using black chalk, sometimes finished with ink. They are now part of the Windsor collection. For example, see figures 141 and 142. Deeply personal yet coolly analytic in parts, they provide a powerful and dark expression of many of the themes of his life. The melding of art and science, the blurred line between experience and fantasy, and the frightful power of nature. The drawings also convey, I believe, his own emotional turmoil as he faced his final days, partly hobbled by a stroke. They became an outlet for his feelings and fears. According to Windsor curator Martin Clayton, they are an outpouring of something really personal, a kind of crescendo at a time when his concerns are more strongly expressed. Throughout his life, he had been obsessed with water and its movements. One of his first drawings, The Landscape of the Arno, done when he was 21, shows a placid river, calm and life-giving, as it meanders gently past fertile land and tranquil villages. It displays no sign of turbulence, just a few gentle ripples. Like a vein, it nourishes life. In his notebooks, there are dozens of references to water as the life-giving fluid that forms the vein that nourishes the earth. Water is the vital humor, vitale umore, of the arid earth, he wrote. Flowing with unceasing vehemence through the ramifying veins, it replenishes all the parts. In the Codex Leicester, he described, by his own count, 657 cases of water and its depths. His mechanical engineering work included close to 100 devices for moving and diverting water. Year after year, he devised plans involving hydrodynamics, which included improving Milan's canal system, flooding the plains around Venice to defend against a Turkish invasion, channeling a direct link from Florence to the sea, diverting the Arno River around Pisa, draining the Pontine marshes for Pope Leo X, and creating a canal system at Romorantin for King Francis I. But now, near the end of his life, he depicted water and its swirls not as calm or tamed, but as filled with fury. The deluge drawings are powerful works of art. The pages contain framing lines, and the backside of each is blank, signalling that they were drawn for display, or perhaps as artistic accompaniments to a reading of an apocalyptic tale, not just as scientific illustrations in a notebook. Some of the most vivid are done in chalk, then lined with ink and tinted with a colour wash. Especially for those who love curls and swirls, as Leonardo did, the drawings are an artistic expression of great aesthetic power. They remind us of the curls cascading down the back of the angel in his Annunciation, the painting he made some 40 years earlier. Indeed, the underdrawing of the angel's curls, as revealed by a spectrographic analysis, is strikingly similar to the spirals of the deluge drawings. The careful and detailed observation of motion was one of Leonardo's specialties, and so too was extending his observation into the realm of fantasy. His deluge drawings are based on storms he had witnessed and described in his notebooks, but they are also the product of a fevered and frenzied imagination. He was a master at blurring lines, and in his deluge drawings he did so between reality and fantasia. Leonardo liked to use both words and drawings to depict his ideas, and this was especially true of the deluge. In three very long passages, totaling more than 2,000 words, he wrote of the deluge and how to represent it in a picture. Much of this was intended for his planned treatise on painting. He wrote as if he were instructing both himself and students. Let the dark and gloomy air be seen buffeted by the rush of contrary winds and dense from the continued rain mingled with hail and bearing hither and thither an infinite number of branches torn from the trees and mixed with numberless leaves. All round may be seen venerable trees uprooted by the fury of the winds, and fragments of mountains, already scoured bare by the torrents, falling into those torrents and choking their valleys till the swollen rivers overflow and submerge the wide lowlands and their inhabitants. You might see on many of the hilltops terrified animals of different kinds, collected together and subdued to tameness, in company with men and women who had fled there with their children. Leonardo's description continues for two closely written pages of his notebook, and by halfway through, he is no longer instructing how to paint a scene. Instead, he has whipped himself into a frenzy, describing the apocalyptic deluge and the emotions of the humans as they are thrashed. Perhaps parts were intended to be performed for the king, accompanied by the pictures. Whatever its purpose, the description descends into the darkest of all Leonardo's fantasia scenes. Others, with desperate act, took their own lives, hopeless of being able to endure such suffering. And of these, some flung themselves from lofty rocks, others strangled themselves with their own hands, others seized their own children and violently slew them at a blow, some wounded and killed themselves with their own weapons, others, falling on their knees, recommended themselves to God. Ah, how many mothers wept over their drowned sons, holding them upon their knees, with arms raised spread out toward heaven, and with words and various threatening gestures upbraiding the wrath of the gods. Others, with clasped hands and fingers clenched, gnawed them and devoured them till they bled, crouching with their breasts down on their knees in their intense and unbearable anguish. Mixed in with the gloomy fantasy are careful observations about how flowing water, when diverted, forms swirls and eddies. The swollen waters will sweep around the pool that contains them, striking in eddying whirlpools against the different obstacles. Even amid the darkest passages, there are specific scientific injunctions. If the heavy masses of large mountains or grand buildings fall into the vast pools of water, a great quantity will be flung into the air, and its movement will be in a contrary direction to that of the object which struck the water. The angle of reflection will be equal to the angle of incidence. The deluge drawings conjure up the story of the flood in Genesis, a topic treated by Michelangelo and many other artists over the years. But Leonardo makes no mention of Noah. He was conveying more than a biblical tale. At one point, he adds Greek and Roman classical gods to the fray. Neptune will be seen in the midst of the water with his trident, and let Aeolus with his winds be shown entangling the trees, floating uprooted and whirling in the huge waves. He drew on Virgil's Aeneid, Ovid's Metamorphosis, and the thunderous natural phenomena in Book 6 of Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. The drawings and text also conjure up the tale he wrote in Milan in the 1490s, ostensibly addressed to the Devadar of Syria. In that story, performed at Ludovico Sforza's court, Leonardo vividly described a sudden rain, or rather a ruinous storm full of water, sand, mud, and stones, all mingled together with roots, stems, and branches of various trees, and every kind of thing came hurtling through the air and descended upon us. Leonardo did not focus on, or for that matter even hint at, the wrath of God in his deluge writings and drawings. He conveyed instead his belief that chaos and destruction are inherent in the raw power of nature. The psychological effect is more harrowing than if he were merely depicting a tale of punishment from an angry god. He was imparting his own emotions and thereby tapping into ours. Hallucinatory and hypnotic, the deluge drawings are the unnerving bookend to a life of nature drawing that began with a sketch of the placid Arno flowing near his native village. The end. On what may be the last page he wrote in his notebooks, Leonardo drew four right triangles with bases of differing lengths, see figure 143. Inside of each, he fit a rectangle, and then he shaded the remaining areas of the triangle. In the center of the page, he made a chart with boxes labeled with the letter of each rectangle, and below it, he described what he was trying to accomplish. As he had done obsessively over the years, he was using the visualization of geometry to help him understand the transformation of shapes. Specifically, he was trying to understand the formula for keeping the area of a right triangle the same while varying the lengths of its two legs. He had fussed with this problem, explored by Euclid, repeatedly over the years. It was a puzzle that, by this point in his life, as he turned 67 and his health faded, might seem unnecessary to solve. To anyone other than Leonardo, it may have been. Then, abruptly, almost at the end of the page, he breaks off his writing with an etc. That is followed by a line written in the same meticulous mirror script as the previous lines of his analysis, explaining why he is putting down his pen. Perché la minestra si fredda, he writes, because the soup is getting cold. It is the final piece of writing we have by Leonardo's hand, our last scene of him working. Picture him in the upstairs study of his manor house, with its beamed ceiling and fireplace, and the view of his royal patron's Chateau d'Amboise. Mathurin, his cook, is down in the kitchen. Perhaps Melzi and others of the household are already at the table. After all these years, he is still stabbing away at geometry problems that have not yielded the world very much, but have given him a profound appreciation of the patterns of nature. Now, however, the soup is getting cold. There is one final document. On April the 23rd, 1519, 8 days after his 67th birthday, Leonardo had his last will and testament drawn up by a notary in Amboise, witnessed and signed. He had been ill, and he realized his final days were approaching. It begins, "Be it known to all persons present and to come, that at the court of our Lord the King at Amboise, before ourselves in person, Messer Leonardo da Vinci, painter to the King, at present staying at the place known as Clue, near Amboise, duly considering the certainty of death and the uncertainty of its time." In his will, Leonardo commended his soul to our Lord Almighty God and to the glorious Virgin Mary. But that seems to have been merely a literary flourish. His science led him to adopt many heretical beliefs, including that the fetus in the womb does not have a soul of its own, and that the biblical flood did not happen. Unlike Michelangelo, a man consumed at times with religious fervor, Leonardo made a point of not expounding much on religion during his lifetime. He said that he would not endeavor to write or give information of those things of which the human mind is incapable and which cannot be proved by an instance of nature. And he left such matters to the minds of friars, fathers of the people, who by inspiration possess the secrets. The first items in his will prescribe what shall be his funeral services. His body will be carried to the church at Amboise by its chaplains. In the said church of Saint Florentin, he specified, 3 high masses shall be celebrated by the deacon and subdeacon, and on the same day 30 low masses shall also be performed as Saint Gregory. This will be followed by 3 masses at the nearby church of Saint-Denis. He wanted 60 candles carried by 60 poor men, to whom shall be given money for carrying them. To Mathurin, the serving woman who made the soup, he bequeathed a cloak of good black woolen cloth lined with fur and 2 ducats. To his half-brothers he fulfilled what had probably been the legal settlement of their earlier dispute by giving them a sizable cash payment and the property he had inherited from his uncle Francesco. As Leonardo's de facto and perhaps legally adopted son and heir, Francesco Melzi was named the executor and bequeathed most of the estate. This included Leonardo's pension, all sums of money owed to him, his clothes, books, writings, and all the instruments and portraits pertaining to his art and calling as a painter. To his most recently hired house servant and companion, Battista de Villanis, Leonardo left the water rights that had been granted him in Milan, as well as half of the vineyard given to him by Ludovico Sforza. He also gave Battista each and all of the articles of furniture and utensils in his house at Clue. And then there was Salai. He was designated to get the other half of the vineyard. Since he was already living there and had built a house on a portion of the land, it would be hard for Leonardo to have done otherwise with the property. But that was all Salai was bequeathed in the will. There had apparently been an estrangement, one that had grown with the ascent of Melzi and the arrival of Battista. Salai was no longer at Leonardo's side when he made the will. Nevertheless, he lived up to his reputation as a sticky-fingered little devil, one who was somehow able to get his hands on things. When he was killed 5 years later by a crossbow, the inventory of his estate showed that, perhaps during a visit to France, he had been given or had taken many copies of Leonardo's paintings and possibly some of the originals, perhaps including the Mona Lisa and Leda and the Swan. Always the con artist, it is unclear whether the prices listed in his estate are true values, thus making it hard to know which were copies. Except for the Leda, which was lost, Whatever original paintings Salai had were returned to France, perhaps having previously been sold by him to the king, and eventually ended up in the Louvre. As a well-spent day brings a happy sleep, Leonardo had written 30 years earlier, so a well-employed life brings a happy death. His came on May the 2nd, 1519, less than 3 weeks after he turned 67. In his biographical essay on Leonardo, Vasari describes a final scene that, as with many of his passages, is likely a mix of truth and his own wishful imagination. Leonardo, he wrote, feeling himself near to death, asked to have himself diligently informed of the teaching of the Catholic faith and of the good way and holy Christian religion. And then, with many moans, he confessed and was penitent. And although he could not raise himself well on his feet, supporting himself on the arms of his friends and servants, he was pleased to take devoutly the most holy sacrament. This trope of a deathbed confession feels like something Vasari, who was not there, would invent, or at least embellish. He was more eager to have Leonardo embrace faith than Leonardo himself probably was. As Vasari knew, Leonardo was not conventionally religious. In the first edition of his biography, he wrote that Leonardo formed in his mind a doctrine so heretical that he depended no more on any religion, perhaps placing scientific knowledge higher than Christian faith. He eliminated that passage in the second edition of the book, presumably to protect Leonardo's reputation. Vasari goes on to recount that King Francis, who was in the habit of making frequent affectionate visits to him, arrived in Leonardo's chambers just as the priest who had performed the last rites was leaving. Leonardo then summoned the strength to sit up and give a description of his illness and its symptoms. Of all parts of Vasari's deathbed account, that is the most believable. It is easy to imagine Leonardo explaining to the smart and curious young king the intricacies of a failing heart and blood vessels. Thereupon he was seized by a paroxysm, the messenger of death, Vasari reports, the king having risen and having taken his head in order to assist him and show him favour to the end, in the hope of alleviating his sufferings, the spirit of Leonardo, which was most divine, conscious that it could attain to no greater honour, breathed its last in the arms of the king. It was a moment so perfect that it was later portrayed by many admiring painters, most notably Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres, see figure 144. And thus we have a fitting and beautiful final scene. Leonardo, cradled on his deathbed by a powerful and doting patron, in a comfortable house surrounded by his favourite paintings. But with Leonardo, nothing is quite so simple. The image of him dying in the arms of the king may or may not be another sentimental myth. We know that King Francis issued a proclamation on May the 3rd at Saint-Germain-en-Laye, which was a 2-day ride from Amboise. So it seems that he could not have actually been with Leonardo the day before. Or then again, perhaps he could have been. The proclamation in question was issued by the king, but was not signed by him. Instead, it was signed by his chancellor, and the records coming out of the council do not mention the king's presence. So there remains the possibility that the king stayed in Amboise to cradle the head of his dying genius. Leonardo was buried in the church of the Château d'Amboise, but the current location of his remains is another mystery. That church was demolished in the early 19th century, and 60 years later the site was excavated and a collection of bones found that may have been those of Leonardo. The bones were reburied at the chapel of Saint-Hubert adjoining the chateau, and a tomb slab was installed, saying it was the site of his presumed remains, rest présumé. As always with Leonardo, in his art and in his life, in his birthplace and now even in his death, there is a veil of mystery. We cannot portray him with crisp, sharp lines, nor should we want to, just as he would not have wanted to portray Mona Lisa that way. There is something nice about leaving a little to our imagination. As he knew, the outlines of reality are inherently blurry, leaving a hint of uncertainty that we should embrace. The best way to approach his life is the way he approached the world, filled with a sense of curiosity and an appreciation for its infinite wonders.
Chapter 33. Conclusion. Genius. In the introduction of this book, I suggested that it was unhelpful to toss around the word genius as if it were a superhuman trait bestowed by heaven and not within the ken of mere mortals. As I hope you will by now agree, Leonardo was a genius, one of the few people in history who indisputably deserved, or to be more precise, earned, that appellation. Yet it's also true that he was a mere mortal. The most obvious evidence that he was human rather than superhuman is the trail of projects he left unfinished. Among them were a horse model that archers reduced to rubble, an adoration scene and battle mural that were abandoned, flying machines that never flew, tanks that never rolled, a river that was never diverted, and pages of brilliant treatises that piled up, unpublished. "Tell me if anything was ever done," he repeatedly scribbled in notebook after notebook. "Tell me, tell me, tell me if I ever did a thing. Tell me if anything was ever made." Of course, the things he did finish were enough to prove his genius. The Mona Lisa alone does that, as do all of his art masterpieces as well as his anatomical drawings. But by the end of writing this book, I even began to appreciate the genius inherent in his designs left unexecuted and masterpieces left unfinished. By skirting the edge of fantasy with his flying machines and water projects and military devices, he envisioned what innovators would invent centuries later. And by refusing to churn out works that he had not perfected, he sealed his reputation as a genius rather than a master craftsman. He enjoyed the challenge of conception more than the chore of completion. One reason that he was reluctant to relinquish some of his works and declare them completed was that he relished a world in flux. He had an uncanny ability to convey movements of the body and the mind, of machines and horses, and of rivers and everything else that flows. "No instant," he wrote, "is self-contained, just as no action in a theatrical pageant, nor any drop in a flowing river, is self-contained. Each moment incorporates what came right before and what is coming right after." Similarly, he looked upon his art and engineering and his treatises as part of a dynamic process, always receptive to a refinement by the application of a new insight. He updated St. Jerome in the Wilderness after 30 years, when his anatomy experiments taught him something new about neck muscles. If he had lived another decade, he likely would have continued to refine the Mona Lisa for that much longer. Relinquishing a work, declaring it finished, froze its evolution. Leonardo did not like to do that. There was always something more to be learned, another stroke to be gleaned from nature that can make a picture closer to perfect. What made Leonardo a genius, what set him apart from people who are merely extraordinarily smart, was creativity, the ability to apply imagination to intellect. His facility for combining observation with fantasy allowed him, like other creative geniuses, to make unexpected leaps that related things seen to things unseen. "Talent hits a target that no one else can hit," wrote the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. "Genius hits a target no one else can see." Because they think different, creative masterminds are sometimes considered misfits. But in the words that Steve Jobs helped craft for an Apple advertisement, "While some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius, because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do." What also distinguished Leonardo's genius was its universal nature. The world has produced other thinkers who are more profound or logical, and many who are more practical. but none who was as creative in so many fields. Some people are geniuses in a particular arena, such as Mozart in music and Euler in math. But Leonardo's brilliance spanned multiple disciplines, which gave him a profound feel for nature's patterns and cross-currents. His curiosity impelled him to become among the handful of people in history who tried to know all there was to know about everything that could be known. There have been, of course, many other insatiable polymaths, and even the Renaissance produced other Renaissance men. But none painted the Mona Lisa, much less did so at the same time as producing unsurpassed anatomy drawings based on multiple dissections, coming up with schemes to divert rivers, explaining the reflection of light from the earth to the moon, opening the still-beating heart of a butchered pig to show how ventricles work, designing musical instruments, choreographing pageants, using fossils to dispute the biblical account of the deluge, and then drawing the deluge. Leonardo was a genius, but more. He was the epitome of the universal mind, one who sought to understand all of creation, including how we fit into it. Learning from Leonardo. The fact that Leonardo was not only a genius, but also very human, quirky and obsessive and playful and easily distracted, makes him more accessible. He was not graced with the type of brilliance that is completely unfathomable to us. Instead, he was self-taught and willed his way to his genius. So even though we may never be able to match his talents, we can learn from him and try to be more like him. His life offers a wealth of lessons. Be curious, relentlessly curious. "I have no special talents," Einstein once wrote to a friend. "I'm just passionately curious." Leonardo actually did have special talents, as did Einstein, but his distinguishing and most inspiring trait was his intense curiosity. He wanted to know what causes people to yawn, how they walk on ice in Flanders, methods for squaring the circle, what makes the aortic valve close, how light is processed in the eye, and what that means for the perspective in a painting. He instructed himself to learn about the placenta of a calf, the jaw of a crocodile, the tongue of a woodpecker, the muscles of a face, the light of the moon, and the edges of shadows. Being relentlessly and randomly curious about everything around us is something each of us can push ourselves to do every waking hour, just like he did. Seek knowledge for its own sake. Not all knowledge needs to be useful. Sometimes it should be pursued for pure pleasure. Leonardo did not need to know how heart valves work to paint the Mona Lisa, nor did he need to figure out how fossils got to the top of mountains to produce Virgin of the Rocks. By allowing himself to be driven by pure curiosity, he got to explore more horizons and see more connections than anyone else of his era. Retain a childlike sense of wonder. At certain points in life, most of us quit puzzling over everyday phenomena. We might savor the beauty of a blue sky, but we no longer bother to wonder why it is that color. Leonardo did. So did Einstein, who wrote to another friend, "You and I never ceased to stand like curious children before the great mystery into which we were born." We should be careful never to outgrow our wonder years, or to let our children do so. Observe. Leonardo's greatest skill was his acute ability to observe things. It was the talent that empowered his curiosity, and vice versa. It was not some magical gift, but a product of his own effort. When he visited the moats surrounding Sforza Castle, he looked at the four-winged dragonflies and noticed how the wing pairs alternate in motion. When he walked around town, he observed how the facial expressions of people relate to their emotions, and he discerned how light bounces off differing surfaces. He saw which birds move their wings faster on the upswing than on the downswing, and which do the opposite. This, too, we can emulate. Water flowing into a bowl? Look, as he did, at exactly how the eddies swirl. Then wonder why. Start with the details. In his notebook, Leonardo shared a trick for observing something carefully. Do it in steps, starting with each detail. A page of a book, he noted, cannot be absorbed in one stare. You need to go word by word. If you wish to have a sound knowledge of the forms of objects, he wrote, begin with the details of them, and do not go on to the second step until you have the first well fixed in memory. See things unseen. Leonardo's primary activity in many of his formative years was conjuring up pageants, performances, and plays. He mixed theatrical ingenuity with fantasy. This gave him a combinatory creativity. He could see birds in flight and also angels, lions roaring and also dragons. Go down rabbit holes. He filled the opening pages of one of his notebooks with 169 attempts to square a circle. In 8 pages of his Codex Lester, he recorded 730 findings about the flow of water. In another notebook, he listed 67 words that describe different types of moving water. He measured every segment of the human body, calculated their proportional relationships, and then did the same for a horse. He drilled down for the pure joy of geeking out. Get distracted. The greatest rap on Leonardo was that these passionate pursuits caused him to wander off on tangents, literally in the case of his math inquiries. It has left posterity the poorer, Kenneth Clark lamented. But in fact, Leonardo's willingness to pursue whatever shiny object caught his eye made his mind richer and filled with more connections. Respect facts. Leonardo was a forerunner of the age of observational experiments and critical thinking. When he came up with an idea, he devised an experiment to test it. And when his experience showed that a theory was flawed, such as his belief that the springs within the earth are replenished the same way as blood vessels in humans, he abandoned his theory and sought a new one. This practice became common a century later, during the age of Galileo and Bacon. It has, however, become a bit less prevalent these days. If we want to be more like Leonardo, we have to be fearless about changing our minds based on new information. Procrastinate. While painting The Last Supper, Leonardo would sometimes stare at the work for an hour, finally making one small stroke, and then leave. He told Duke Ludovico that creativity requires time for ideas to marinate and intuitions to gel. Men of lofty genius sometimes accomplish the most when they work the least, he explained, for their minds are occupied with their ideas and the perfection of their conceptions, to which they afterwards give form. Most of us don't need advice to procrastinate. We do it naturally. But procrastinating like Leonardo requires work. It involves gathering all the possible facts and ideas, and only after that, allowing the collection to simmer. Let the perfect be the enemy of the good. When Leonardo could not make the perspective in the Battle of Anghiari, or the interaction and the adoration of the Magi work perfectly, he abandoned them rather than produce a work that was merely good enough. He carried around masterpieces, such as his St. Anne and the Mona Lisa, to the end, knowing there would always be a new stroke he could add. Likewise, Steve Jobs was such a perfectionist that he held up shipping the original Macintosh until his team could make the circuit boards inside look beautiful, even though nobody would ever see them. Both he and Leonardo knew that real artists care about the beauty even of the parts unseen. Eventually, Jobs embraced a counter-maxim, real artists ship, which means that sometimes you ought to deliver a product even when there are still improvements that could be made. That's a good rule for daily life, but there are times when it's nice to be like Leonardo and not let go of something until it's perfect. Think visually. Leonardo was not blessed with the ability to formulate math equations or abstractions, so he had to visualize them, which he did with his study of proportions, his rules of perspective, his method for calculating reflections from concave mirrors, and his way of changing one shape into another of the same size. Too often, when we learn a formula or a rule, even one so simple as the method for multiplying numbers or mixing a paint color, we no longer visualize how it works. As a result, we lose our appreciation for the underlying beauty of nature's laws. Avoid silos. At the end of many of his product presentations, Jobs displayed a slide of a sign that showed the intersection of liberal arts and technology streets. He knew that at such crossroads lay creativity. Leonardo had a free-range mind that merrily wandered across all the disciplines of the arts, sciences, engineering, and humanities. His knowledge of how light strikes the retina helped inform the perspective in The Last Supper, and on a page of anatomical drawings depicting the dissection of lips, he drew the smile that would reappear in the Mona Lisa. He knew that art was a science and that science was an art. Whether he was drawing a fetus in the womb or the swirls of a deluge, he blurred the distinction between the two. Let your reach exceed your grasp. Imagine, as he did, how you would build a human-powered flying machine or divert a river. Even try to devise a perpetual motion machine or square a circle using only a ruler and a compass. There are some problems we will never solve. Learn why. Indulge fantasy. His giant crossbow, the turtle-like tanks, his plans for an ideal city, the man-powered mechanisms to flap a flying machine. Just as Leonardo blurred the lines between science and art, he did so between reality and fantasy. It may not have produced flying machines, but it allowed his imagination to soar. Create for yourself, not just for patrons. No matter how hard the rich and powerful Marchesa Isabella d'Este begged, Leonardo would not paint her portrait. But he did begin one of a silk merchant's wife named Lisa. He did it because he wanted to, and he kept working on it for the rest of his life, never delivering it to the silk merchant. Collaborate. Genius is often considered the purview of loners who retreat to their garrets and are struck by creative lightning. Like many myths, that of the lone genius has some truth to it, but there's usually more to the story. The Madonnas and drapery studies produced in Verrocchio's studio, and the versions of Virgin of the Rocks and Madonna the Yarn Winder and other paintings from Leonardo's studio were created in such a collaborative manner that it's hard to tell whose hand made which strokes. Vitruvian Man was produced after sharing ideas and sketches with friends. Leonardo's best anatomy studies came when he was working in partnership with Marcantonio della Torre. and his most fun work came from collaborations on theatrical productions and evening entertainments at the Sforza Court. Genius starts with individual brilliance. It requires singular vision. But executing it often entails working with others. Innovation is a team sport. Creativity is a collaborative endeavor. Make lists. And be sure to put odd things on them. Leonardo's to-do list may have been the greatest testaments to pure curiosity the world has ever seen. Take notes on paper. 500 years later, Leonardo's notebooks are still around to astonish and inspire us. 50 years from now, our own notebooks, if we work up the initiative to start writing them, will be around to astonish and inspire our grandchildren, unlike our tweets and Facebook posts. Be open to mystery. Not everything needs sharp lines. Coda. Describe the tongue of the woodpecker. The tongue of a woodpecker can extend more than 3 times the length of its bill. When not in use, it retracts into the skull, and its cartilage-like structure continues past the jaw to wrap around the bird's head and then curve down into its nostril. In addition to digging out grubs from a tree, the long tongue protects the woodpecker's brain. When the bird smashes its beak repeatedly into tree bark, the force exerted on its head is 10 times what would kill a human. But its bizarre tongue and supporting structure act as a cushion, shielding the brain from shock. There's no reason you actually need to know any of this. It's information that has no real utility for your life, just as it had none for Leonardo. But I thought maybe, after reading this book, that you, like Leonardo, who one day put "Describe the Tongue of the Woodpecker" on one of his eclectic and oddly inspiring to-do lists, would want to know. Just out of curiosity. Pure curiosity.
Leonardo da Vinci was written by Walter Isaacson and read by Alfred Molina, with the introduction and conclusion read by Walter Isaacson. It was recorded by Chris McNaughton at Rocky Mountain Recorders in Denver and Jason Rhine at Marini Recording Studio in New Orleans. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Leonardo da Vinci was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Leonardo da Vinci is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.